Hey folks, thank you for tuning in to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you want to learn more about this project, you can do so at the website lastbornthewilderness.com. A link to that website is in the description of this episode. That website will have everything. It'll have social media links if you want to follow this project on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. You'll also find links to the various platforms this podcast is on, that it's streaming from, and you can subscribe to this podcast on. It includes SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Radio Public. That's what I'm thinking of. Radio Public's the newest one that I put on there. So if any of those are your preferred places to listen to podcasts, please subscribe and maybe write a review or something if that's available. Just, you know, do that thing. And you'll also find a link to the one-time donation page. If you want to send a small donation, you can also become a contributor to this podcast, a monthly contributor to this podcast through the Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. You can make as little as a dollar a month contributions to the production of this thing, and you'll gain early access to the interviews and conversations a week in advance without all this extra stuff that I throw at the beginning of these episodes. So please consider becoming a supporter of this project through that. For those that are supporting me already, thank you so much again for your contributions. Thank you all for your attention up this point. Here's the episode. In this episode, I speak with Max Wilbert. Max has a 15-year history as an organizer and a revolutionary. He is a co-founder of Deep Green Resistance. So Max just released this book. It's a collection of pro-feminist and environmental essays on civilization, on the culture that we are a part of, on the mass extinction event that is currently underway on this planet. He discusses a lot of different subjects, discusses resistance and active resistance against industrial society, against the empire, as it were. So this collection of essays is titled We Choose to Speak. And he was kind enough to send me a copy of this before the interview, so I had a chance to read some of his essays. And in this conversation, I mean, we have a very real conversation about not only Max Wilbert's story, where he comes from, why he believes what he believes and has the passion he does for what he, you know, regarding his activism, regarding his writings, regarding advocating for the things that he is advocating. You know, we discuss that, but we discuss the really tricky, but also really blunt, realization and discussion on how do we actively dismantle a culture, our civilization, an economic system that is actively destroying all life on the planet in some form or another. I mean, most of the life systems of this planet are being undermined by industrial activity, by human industrial activity. So what can we do? And I mean, there's some really serious things that we say regarding what needs to be done, in resisting this genocide, this ecocide that is currently underway. But this is really just an honest conversation about the state of affairs and Max's work. So I thank him for contacting me, for, knowing that this would be a good fit. And that we would have a really good conversation. So I'm glad to speak with him. If you want to learn more about Max and his book, you can go to maxwilbert.org. You also find links to his book there. You buy it directly from him, or you can buy it on various other websites. And I'll provide links to all that in the description of this episode. So I thank Max for his time, for having this really good conversation about some really important topics, I think, that need to be discussed more and more frequently by people. We need to stop pretending that things are fine when they're not. Thank you, Max. Thank you all for your attention up to this point. Here's the episode. Well, Max, thank you for doing this, man. Thank you for reaching out to me. You have this really excellent collection of essays, and I can't remember exactly the span of time that these essays were written, but I would say over the course of a decade. Am I right in saying that?
It's about a six-year period.
Six-year period, okay. A little under a decade then. Yeah, and it's called We Choose to Speak, and it's you were really kind and sent me a copy of that, so I was had a chance to go over these essays, and I really like the... I mean, I've become familiar with Deep Green Resistance. I've become familiar with Derek Jensen, of course, and as a result, I've become more familiar with you and your work. And becoming familiar with the ideas that you present in these essays, I mean, they really resonate really deeply with me, even though I wouldn't say that I'm nearly, I'm not an activist on the level that you are, like, in that you go out and you're actually, you're going to resistance camps. You're actually speaking to people on the ground level and trying to, foment some kind of active resistance. But I am deeply moved by people who are willing to put their neck out and are willing to stand up and say, you know, we choose to speak. You know, the culture itself may be destructive and maybe, you know, pushing all of us and every living thing and the entire planet towards the edge of a precipice. But there are still people who are able to see it for what it really is and speak on it and still advocate, you know, for some sort of, I don't want to say revolution because that may not be actually what it is, but it's an active form of resistance against this really destructive force that is our culture and our civilization. And so becoming familiar with your work has been really more than just informative. It reminds me that there are people who have their head above the tide, I guess you could say, and can see the direction that we're all heading in and are willing to speak up and point to directions that we can take as far as resisting that. So it's been really good going over those essays and seeing what you are doing as an activist and as a fellow human being on this planet we share. So I know I had sent you some questions ahead of time and some general topics that I wanted to discuss, but I think a good place to start, because I really like to understand where people are coming from, because everybody has their own personal story, I guess, and how they come into their political and their political consciousness, right? How they come to understand the world as it is. So, I mean, there's a bit of a bio, you know, but obviously that you put out there, but I just want to know, like, what exactly... I know that probably wasn't one thing, but there probably were a series of events in your life, series of things that you witnessed that really triggered and pushed you in the path, towards the path that you are going in now. Is there anything in particular that you would like be willing to share with me and with the listeners regarding this journey that you've been on?
Sure. Yeah. And thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciated it. And, I enjoy listening to your other guests, so it's great to get to be on.
Yeah, thank you.
So as far as my background, I grew up in Seattle, and I grew up in a somewhat conscious environment. My mother was a midwife for many years, so she was in the feminist movement. My father was involved in media work, and so he brought this sort of critical media analysis into our household. And as I'm sure you and many of the listeners know, once you start being critical about the messages that you're getting from the corporate media, you can take that same sort of critical spirit of inquiry and apply it across all different parts of your life. So as far as a real political awakening, it's kind of a funny story. When I was in fifth grade, one of my best friends passed me the Communist Manifesto. And I don't think I really had any idea what it was, and I didn't end up as a communist, but you know, we're in fifth grade, so of course we had to adapt this to our own situation. So we talked about how the teachers were like the bourgeoisie and the students were the proletariat, because we didn't want to be there. We didn't want to be trapped in these classrooms and being forced to learn these things that felt completely irrelevant to our real lives. And so it was sort of a joke, really, but it set my mind on fire. And so that was at a pretty young age. And then growing up, you know, moving through middle school and into high school, my sister was getting involved in a lot of anti-racist organizing in Seattle. And this was Seattle in the late 90s, early 2000s, post-WTO, basically. So the anti-globalization movement had a huge influence on the politics going on in Seattle at that time. And that movement had a great analysis of the harms of so-called free trade. And there was a big focus on the Zapatistas as an early influence in the community. The Cuban Revolution was a big influence in the community. Obviously, there are flaws with any model. Cuba didn't turn out to be, you know, a utopian perfect vision. But nonetheless, I think we can learn from these examples. And so I guess the point is, I learned early on that the correct role models to look up to are those who are willing to fight and even potentially die for justice. You know, whether we're talking about early indigenous resistance to colonization or, you know, the Wobblies taking on the Bossas, I got that lesson early on that you always side with the oppressed, and also that at least potentially any means necessary to fight for justice is justified. And so, you know, we can critique and disagree with and learn from methods that we may not like, but if we're not there in their situation, we can't really say how we'd react. So another big influence on me in terms of the natural world was I grew up spending time every summer on the coast of what's now called Washington State, in Macaw territory, Macaw tribal land. And it's a place where obviously people lived for at least many thousand years. And because this place is protected partly in a national park, it's an ecological paradise even today, at least compared to the rest of the world. So I grew up contrasting that with the city. I grew up in the heart of Seattle. So I grew up contrasting this old-growth forest, open beach environment with kelp forests and whales swimming by and bald eagles and a whole intact natural community, almost intact, with the city and the concrete and the pollution and the poverty and all of that. And so I think that I didn't really realize that lesson until later in life, but it was very viscerally teaching me that people can live in a place without destroying it. And obviously that's not only possible, but there are thousands of examples of that all around the world. So I guess one more experience that I can just mention, you know, as you can imagine, I got pretty radical at a pretty young age. But another big influence on me was 8 years ago in 2010, I had the opportunity to travel to the Russian Arctic as part of a climate science expedition. And we were in northeastern Siberia, and I actually got to see permafrost thawing out and walk among these forests that were collapsing as the soil liquefied under them, and to watch methane bubbling out of these warming lakes. And I documented the work that the scientists were doing, and I talked to them about the implications of that and how they as human beings felt about the work that they were doing and what they were seeing. And as part of this, I ended up interviewing about 10 Arctic climate scientists and making a documentary about global warming in the Arctic, which is the canary in the coal mine. And so that was also a really formative, powerful experience. But, you know, those are some of the highlights, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily the case that one single experience changed everything for me. It was really a building process.
Of course. Yeah, it's a progression. And so I remember reading an essay, I think it was the first essay in your collection, where you do discuss the first time reading Karl Marx, and it was electrifying, right? I mean, it's an awakening and be a crystallizing moment for many people to read this, because it kind of explains things for you. It puts things within a certain model that you can reflect on human history and reflect on your place in that, this, you know, human history. And you can then understand, well, who do I, you know, why are things the way they are? Because I think, especially at a young age, and I think children in particular, like you mentioned, you had access to a ecological gem, this place that was just not completely untouched, of course, but was still very intact in a lot of ways. And then you can compare that to the city that you were in probably most of the time. And you have to ask yourself, well, why is this so different from this place? And then you have to try to figure out, well, you know, it's actually a really kind of a painful experience to grow up recognizing that the culture that we're a part of is destructive, ultimately, right? It's a painful awakening. And then the question that you have to ask, I think after you get through that initial, maybe it might come as sorrow or depression or whatever it may come, whatever form it, anger, of course, is a part of it as well. Then the question is, well, then what is to be done, right? Where do we go and what direction do I take as an individual? And I think, that's where, you know, intellectual and, maybe intellectual political curiosity comes in, and you start to explore, well, it's not just something that Karl Marx can put his finger on and explain away. There's something else going on here. And I really liked that in that first essay you discuss. It goes much deeper than just, than what Karl Marx would have said, maybe, or Marx or Engels or any of these, kind of classic, left-wing, intellectuals might point to, which is that it's all capitalism. It's all the, you know, this one group or one economic system that's the problem. And while that's definitely a big part of it, something that I really appreciate about what you and what others, I think a Deep Green Resistance have done is it's, yes, it's capitalism and yes, it's all of these things, but we need to question the underlying structure of all of this, which is civilization itself. And, and then I guess that would lead into my next question then is what is different about, say, a more Marxist or maybe a traditional leftist critique of capitalism versus, say, what Deep Green Resistance or any of these other, groups or resistance movements that are trying to point to something much deeper than that?
Right. Well, I guess first I would say that, you know, I don't fundamentally disagree with the Marxist analysis of capitalism. I think it makes total sense. And obviously capitalism, global capitalism, is the main structure that's currently shaping the manner in which the planet is being destroyed and in which, you know, all these different atrocities are taking place. So, you know, I wouldn't say that any of that is wrong. I would simply say that there are sort of layers to this issue. it's a big question. And,
yeah, I know. Yeah.
So maybe we can define civilization first. So
yeah,
there are a lot of different definitions out there, and one of the most common ones is, civilization is a way of life defined by cities and agriculture. And a city is defined as any population of humans living in dense enough numbers that the necessities of life have to be routinely imported. So they can't produce what they need in the place where they live. They have to get it from elsewhere. So this can kind of get into the weeds and into the realm of philosophy and speculation about deep history. And I know you're into that and do it on the show, and I love listening to those shows too, but I'm not interested in spending that much time on it. I'm not going to go out and study philosophy because I just think we need to focus on, for me at least, I need to focus on the real world, what's happening to us right now. So, it's been the case for hundreds and even thousands of years that this culture, as it's set up today, is killing the planet. And some people, you know, make the case that capitalism began the destruction of the planet. But I don't think that's true. If you look, for example, at the work of William Ruddeman, he is a climate scientist, paleoclimate scientist, and he's the pioneer of what's called the early Anthropocene hypothesis, which is the idea that global warming actually began as mass agriculture spread across the planet thousands of years ago. So it didn't actually start with industrialism and the coal age, as is commonly believed, but it actually goes back thousands of years. And this is pretty well backed up by the climate science, as far as I know. You look at studies like the one that came out about a year ago in, I think it was in Science, one of the most prestigious journals out there, saying that 46% of all trees have been lost since the beginning of human civilization. And then you add on top of that the destruction of grasslands, the plowing of meadows, the damming and channelizing of rivers, and so on, all across the planet for thousands of years. So, and much of this has really been fueled by imperialism and patriarchy. So there's a great deal of evidence out there that as civilizations move into agriculture, a few different things happen. So first, the population grows. Because there's more food available and there's also more need for workers because it's hard work out there in the fields. So, and second, you see that the land begins to be destroyed. So the forests have to be cut down. The soil becomes saline as salt starts to build up from irrigation and so on. There's erosion. There's a great book on the topic of erosion called Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. And by a guy named David Montgomery, who's a soil scientist, and he traces civilizations. You can actually see the history of civilizations by erosion on the landscape, by soil being swept away. And in places like Italy, where civilization has been active for thousands of years, cities that were port cities when the Roman Empire was active are in some cases 10 miles inland now. And what happened was so much soil eroded from the uplands that it just filled in all these bays and the entire coastline, you know, shifted outwards as all the soil was lost. And throughout all this, as sort of a side note, you're also seeing people's health plummet. That's really clear in the archaeological record. You're seeing people get much shorter. You're seeing more evidence on the bones of disease. Injury and all kinds of problems. And the third thing that you see as a civilization moves increasingly into agriculture is that as that ecology collapses or is destroyed around them, the society essentially has to make a choice between expansion or collapse. And expansion generally means warfare. And this is one of the main driving factors behind civilization, this constant growth imperative. So all this is kind of a big generalization, right? We're not getting into super specific details here, but it's a real trend that you can see playing out historically and today too. And for that reason, sometimes I like to talk about the culture of empire rather than using the term civilization. Just because I think that's easier for people to relate to and understand. I think that's how I define civilization, as the culture of empire, the culture of extraction. And, so once you sort of have that big picture, I don't know, you talked about having your head above the water, and I often feel and have felt for a long time since I was a young teenager involved in some of the political work in Seattle that so many people who are doing great work in the world, they just get their heads stuck in the nitty-gritty day-to-day. And that's not to say that people are doing bad work. That's not what I'm trying to say at all. But I think we really need to maintain a big perspective in order to have a chance of winning, of really turning these things around.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that this is the balance that can be achieved within a successful resistance movement where you have maybe individuals who are more, I guess you could say, in the nitty gritty? They're the ones that are dealing with the small details, the, you know, how do we effectively organize on the ground? How do we deal with all the various personalities on the various complex issues that come into organizing resistance. And then you have the people who are like, well, we need long-term thinking here. We can't just think about the day to day. Both of these things are incredibly vital and important. And I think that's what's so valuable about maybe what we're discussing here is to have this bigger perspective, because I think people do get caught up in, I mean, just an example. I mean, when I have talked to people about this recent, I know this isn't really related to what we're talking about, but the recent controversy regarding the collusion story with Trump and Russia and all this shit that's going on. And it's all just a bunch of nonsense because when one looks at the bigger picture, you're like, well, isn't this what empires do to each other anyway? I mean, I really could care less about whether or not there was some, I don't even think there was, but I think that oftentimes people get lost in the inertia of this media frenzy that's generated oftentimes, I think, to distract us away from something that's actually truly pressing. Yeah. It seems appropriate that at a time when we need actual action to maybe actively undermine the structures of our culture and civilization that are, I mean, every last resource is being extracted, every last forest is being burned down or destroyed or turned into some agricultural project. The oceans are in dire straits. I mean, all of these things are happening, and they're happening much more rapidly than I think most people are even able to comprehend for various reasons. And here we are bickering about pretty much nothing, you know, something that's pretty irrelevant to the bigger issue. But at the same time, we need to have some sort of grounding in the day-to-day reality of the political landscape, I guess.
And
seems to be a really difficult balance between those two.
Yeah, and you know, I used to watch the news every day, and you know, I had to stop for a couple of reasons. One being what you just said, that you get sucked into all these trivial stories that don't really matter. And you know, I was watching for years. I was watching Democracy Now, and the second reason I stopped watching was I just realized Democracy Now is a really liberal show. It's so liberal. I just got so frustrated with the political perspectives that were being aired on that show over and over again, year after year, not really bring any sort of edge, any sort of revolutionary perspective. But to your larger point around the day-to-day organizing stuff, I think, you know, I don't think it's that any of us can afford to ignore the people who are with or organizing in our communities or, you know, dealing with those personalities, like you were saying. I think we all need to focus on that stuff, but I think we need to shape our work within a broader perspective, you know? And one of the questions that you wrote to me that you wanted to discuss earlier was, how our movements are so often reactive, and our struggles are so often defensive. And this is something that I think you can see brilliantly going on with the Trump administration is they are keeping everyone who's against them off balance. So in terms of like the mainstream Democratic Party politicians plus, you know, sort of the more slightly more leftist Bernie centrist progressives, keeping them off balance by just sort of keeping this drum roll of horrible things coming. To, you know, that just sort of keeps everyone overwhelmed, and people are basically fighting to stop things from getting worse or to hold a certain line. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's really important work. Defensive work is critical, but it's not often talked about that other horrible projects and policies are going through elsewhere with basically no resistance. And of course, whatever's already operating is continuing to operate. So, you know, I think about this a lot in terms of resistance to coal, oil, and gas industry. And I saw this graphic years ago, and I actually saved it because it really stuck in my head. And it's a world map, and it's showing the largest dirty energy expansions by 2020. So that's in 2 years now. It probably was almost 10 years ago that this graphic came out. And the project shows coal export terminals, offshore oil drilling, tar sands, fracking projects, conventional oil and gas projects, basically major, major projects taking place all across the world on almost every continent, adding billions of tons of these substances to the global supply. And broadly speaking, the movement has been unable to stop this expansion. So there have been some successes. Obviously, a lot of the coal export terminals along the west coast of the U.S. Have been successfully fought off, at least for now. The Unistone camp up in B.C. has shut down some of those major tar sands and fracking pipelines, again, at least for now. But largely speaking, we've been unable to stop the growth in coal, oil, and gas industries, let alone to actually roll back and turn off the already existing pipelines and refineries and so on, right? So defense is critical. You've got to have defense, but a fundamental part of military strategy is that it's impossible to win with defense alone. And we're really seeing this play out. And I guess even if you look at this issue on a tactical level, defensive struggles, we don't have the ability to hold ground very well. I guess one counterexample might be the ZAD in France. It's been a struggle. They haven't necessarily been able to hold ground, but they've been able to retake it after police forces have left the area. But look at Standing Rock. Look at so many other examples in this country and elsewhere. When our resistance movements are static in one location and attempting to defend one place, that allows the state and corporations to mobilize so many resources. They bring in equipment, different agencies, they conduct surveillance, they infiltrate, and they've become a lot smarter and more effective since the COINTELPRO days in the 60s and 70s. You know, these organizations are extremely skilled at breaking up movements, breaking up alliances, creating fractures. So if we can't even hold ground, then we're going to struggle to defend certain areas, which is what we've seen over the years. Like I said, a few victories here and there, but the overall trend is that everything is getting worse, and it's getting worse at an accelerating rate, right? So every year things are worse than the year before, and that rate is accelerating. So I think we need to move beyond that reactive approach. I think we need to, you know, maybe in some cases ignore state and corporate provocations, even though that's sort of a Faustian bargain. You know, there's no good options in the situations that we're in. But, you know, you can't win with defense. And so I think we need to potentially look at targeting the systems of power, the real pillars that give the system its strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, before we started recording this thing, I was just sort of talking about how we were going to get into this topic of what we should talk about regarding actively resisting, what active resistance would really look like, direct action. Now, there are, like you mentioned, talking about a defensive posture and what defense looks like. And we could look to Standing Rock, and we could look to these various efforts to defend, patches of land, pieces of parts of rivers or wherever it is, in that they want to defend this space. But at the same time they're doing that, corporations and the like are actively putting a lot of different, resources into trying to get around that and figuring out how to, you know, I mean, they have a lot more resources at their disposal than any resistance movement could ever have. So considering the state of things, and I think this is the thing, symbolic gestures aren't going to do anything. Going out in the streets with placards and, you know, saying, hey, you know, stop doing a thing, or, you know, some million person climate change march isn't going to do anything. In my humble opinion, I think that it's a nice gesture, but that isn't going to stop people from, isn't going to stop major corporations, isn't going to stop gas companies or oil companies from doing what they want to do. They're going to continue to keep on pushing forward. You know, we're going to continue to see this massive exploitation of our environment, of natural resources, of the life systems of this planet. So let's not pretend it's otherwise. Let's not pretend it's anything but this. So considering this is the reality of the situation and we should not cherry code it or cherry pick the facts and data, what, in speaking in generalizations here, what are active forms of resistance that small or larger groups of people can engage in in order to really deal serious blows to the systems as they are now?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it?
Yep.
just to preface this, to back up, I guess, what you just said. So the private intelligence and corporate security company Stratfor was part of some documents were leaked and published online a few years ago from this company. And, you know, we're all sort of more familiar with groups like Blackwater and Tiger Swan, but Stratfor is one of these groups that's sort of behind the scenes, often running the show. So they're a very big player in the corporate security world. And one of the quotes from the leaked documents was, "Most authorities will tolerate a certain amount of activism because it is seen as a way to let off steam. They appease the protesters by letting them think they are making a difference, as long as the protesters do not pose a threat. But as protest movements grow, authorities will act more aggressively to neutralize the organizers." So I think that's pretty key. I think that not only should we be aware that, you know, symbols are important, obviously. You know, I grew up going to a lot of big protests and marches, and they were important for my political development in some ways. But I think we need to recognize that not only are these things sometimes not helping materially in terms of the real issues, but sometimes they're actually hurting by diverting energy. And I think a lot of that is due to, you know, major nonprofits, especially, who have a lot to gain from, for example, being able to put on a grant application that we organized a march that brought 500,000 people out in the streets, and we, you know, delivered 5,000 letters to our senators, and, you know, they need those deliverables. And, I think the nonprofit, industrial complex, as some people call it, has a lot to answer for in terms of why our movements have been ineffective. But as, you know, as far as the alternative, I think we need revolutionary movements. And I've been trying to reclaim this word, and people sometimes think that I mean metaphorically, like a revolution in the mind. But I don't. I think we actually need revolution as in armed overthrow of the current system in, it's pretty terrifying to me that as the world is increasingly chaotic, it's the right wing and the ultra right that is highly armed and advocates for using and training in firearms and weapons. Well, the main block of the left, which is the people who generally care more about things like human rights and feminism and rejecting racism and bigotry, that these people are also rejecting weapons completely. And I understand that impulse. My grandpa was a conscientious objector. You know, I come from a family with a deep tradition of anti-war activism and peace work. And, you know, I remember going to his funeral in the Quaker Meeting House in Seattle. And then, you know, I think about the reality that one thing the Quakers are famous for is allowing the Black Panthers to have a meeting in their Philadelphia meeting house and standing around the outside of the building to protect them from police violence. So I don't think that there's a contradiction behind that deep desire for, you know, peace and nonviolence and human rights and the dignity that comes with that, and a fierce desire for justice that leads people to fight. So, you know, one of the common responses people have to this is to say something like, you know, you're going to get smashed by the state and the military and the police. And it's true. We're helplessly outgunned, you know, this is called an asymmetric struggle. It means that one side has much more power and weaponry than the other. And people have figured out over centuries of these types of conflicts that there are ways to be effective in these situations. And, you know, guerrilla warfare is the most well-known of those options, but I don't think that that's really appropriate in our situation.
But I think there is something that gives us a greater chance of success, and it sort of builds on the idea. So Clausewitz was this Prussian military officer in the early 1800s, and he wrote a book called On War, which is probably the single most influential book on military strategy that's ever been written, up there with Sun Tzu, I would say. And he has this theory called the center of gravity. And Gene Sharp, who's a nonviolent theorist of strategy, and Gene Sharp, interestingly enough, he talks about nonviolence as a form of warfare. It's warfare by other means. And I wish that a lot of activists who are working in this framework would recognize that and bring that sort of more sense of seriousness and urgency to it. He has a similar theory that's called pillars of power. So center of gravity and pillars of power. And the idea is pretty simple. It's you analyze your opponent and you determine what are the primary things that give them their power. So, you know, that could be a charismatic individual. It could be a certain technology that they have access to. It could be as simple as they have the biggest army and the most weapons. So we can use this analysis and apply it to the global industrial culture, the culture of empire or civilization. And we will see if we do that analysis that the global economy, which exists to serve those in power and grow their power by exploiting everything, is built on a few different pillars, like the energy system, communication system, the financial system, global trade networks, the electric grid, and the very centralization of these systems, the modern technology that runs them, makes that vulnerable, right? So, you know, one thing that comes up a lot when I bring this up is the internet, because, you know, I say things like, we need to take down the global economy, and people say things like, but what about the internet? It's made it so easy to learn about resistance movements and so easy to connect with other activists around the world. And it just kind of makes me shake my head, because the idea that, I mean, that we have to understand that the internet is used vastly more effectively by the military and corporations than it is by resistance activists, right? These systems are set up to serve those in power, and we sort of maybe get these like side benefits from these systems here and there. But one, it really depends on your position in empire. If you're living in the center of empire, yeah, maybe you're going to get some good benefits. But if you're, you know, in one of the colonies or on the fringes of empire, then, you know, you're not getting anything out of this generally. You know, and in many cases, the sort of quote unquote development that brings in electricity and the internet and all this, that sort of development actually completely destroys traditional communities. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes was from this indigenous Amazonian woman. And I'm sorry, I don't have the name of her people in front of me, cause I didn't pull it up, but she said something like, we're fighting not to have roads and electricity. I love that quote because she understands, you know, those people understand that when the roads come in, when the electricity comes in, that's bringing in this monster that is globalism, that is industrial civilization. And so, like I said, the centralization makes these systems vulnerable. And so the other part of this is that every empire falls, right? This culture will not last forever, and it's already pushing against all the ecological limits. There's one study out there that says 40% of all human deaths are due to pollution. So, you know, the writing is on the wall. This empire is going to collapse at some time, and it won't be pretty when it does. So ultimately, the question is not do we want the empire to collapse? The question is, when will the empire collapse, and can we do it in the best possible way? Can we manage that collapse in some way? So I look at that question and I say, first, the sooner the better, because 200 species are being driven extinct every day, you know, however many football fields of forest are being cut down every day, millions of tons of greenhouse gases, and all those rates are accelerating like we've been talking about. And as far as how that can be done, I don't think there's any sign we're going to see a voluntary shift. You look at Donald Trump, you look at rightward shifts politically around the globe, you look at even so-called leftist politicians and their tepid policies in terms of anything around the core functioning of empire. You look at, you know, polls and opinion data, you look at the concentration of wealth and power in our society. You know, it hasn't been this concentrated since the 20s, the Gilded Age, when, you know, which led directly to the Great Depression. Although obviously, of course, the rich profit, whether the economy is booming or whether it's collapsing, they're going to be fine either way. So there's no sign of a voluntary shift happening. So given those stakes, I think it's going to come down to revolution. And I think we're going to have to target those global systems and actively dismantle them until the global industrial economy collapses. And I don't see this as like a magic wand that we can wave that will solve every problem. Not by a long shot. I think if or when the global economy collapses, it will obviously create new problems. But I think the crucial point is that if that happens, then we have the possibility of surviving as a species. And the non-human world has a chance of surviving and healing. And I don't see any way within the current paradigm that humanity and non-humans are going to survive what's coming down the pipeline and what's happening now. So I don't know how easy this will be. I don't think it necessarily has a great chance of success. But for me, I look at it, like I said, as one of our few options. And, you know, we don't live in a Hollywood world where the good guys always win. You know, in fact, it's the opposite, if anything. But I guess one of my favorite quotes on this topic is from a guy named Michael McFaul, who was on the National Security Council. And his quote was that beforehand, all revolutions seem impossible. In retrospect, all revolutions seem inevitable. So that's my hope, is that, you know, in 20 years, in 50 years, in 100 years, people will look back at our time and say, you know, it was inevitable that this global system that was eating the planet was going to come down, and, you know, thank the goddess that there were people who were brave enough and had the skills and organized and made that happen, because they're the reason that we can still exist.
Right. You know, something I think is that you are pointing to something that's absolutely true. We have this sense that there isn't going to be this great revolution, right? That it isn't inevitable that the proletariat are going to shake off their chains and, you know, rise up against the bourgeoisie and the elites and take, you know, back what is theirs. It's not inevitable that people are going to wake up to the ecological crisis that's unfolding. I look around every day and I don't see that happening. I see that people are buckling down on their beliefs, whatever it may be. Yeah. And even though there may be some pretty strong indications, I mean, just a really obvious one. I mean, we've had record-breaking temperatures all around the world this year, and every year it's getting hotter and hotter. Every summer it's getting hotter and hotter. There's more droughts. There's, you know, people are pretty, I think, on a local level, they might see like, this is kind of weird. This is getting kind of weird. And they're like, well, this is a global trend. And that's just, I mean, imagine if you were living in, I'm just thinking of like this devastating article I read once about Borneo. And just the massive deforestation project that has been going on past several decades, or however long it's been since they've started just clear-cutting massive sections of the really some of the most biodiverse regions on the planet, or once some of the most biodiverse regions. If you're living in that spot, it's very real. It's very visceral. You feel the injustice. It's just right there. I think when you are nestled, and I think you mentioned this, nestled within the heart of the empire, like me, I definitely sense that I exist in some state of privilege because I'm a white male living in the United States of America. And I can, and I can say as much bullshit as I want and throw it, you know, and say whatever I want against the state or the capitalism or whatever. But, you know, I'm pretty comfortable. So to shake myself out of this comfort level, this state of, complacency that I've definitely been born into, you know, there really aren't very many people out there who are willing to take that leap. And I think this is the thing, I was fascinated for a minute when I was a little younger. I was fascinated by, Theodore Kaczynski, right? The Unabomber, right? He lived in a cabin in the woods and he made these homemade bombs and sent them out to these various people who were involved in technology and in computer science and all this. And, you know, he was an individual fighting against everybody. Basically. And he got caught, obviously, and he's not a model that we should look towards, because one, he's this idea of an individual fighting everything and everybody. And I think we need to recognize that there are other people out there who have similar aims and similar understandings and intuitions about what is wrong with the state of affairs today. And I guess reaching out and forming a real coherent and cohesive, real coherent vision and understanding of what a resistance movement would look like. And this is my thing, you know, I want to ask you about this, because certain people are going to be uncomfortable. Like you were discussing, people on the right and the hard right, they're very comfortable with the idea of militant resistance to whatever they perceive to be a threat, right?
Right.
I mean, you hear this online. I mean, I've read more and more now, especially in the age of Trump, you know, people openly discussing that, we can't wait for the day that we can go out and kill you liberals, or we can kill you, you know, kill you people and start a race war. You know, this isn't some speculative, like, what if. This is actually something that I think there are groups of people, large groups of people that are waiting for the right moment for them to do what they want to do. And there's really nothing on the left, from what I can tell, that is actively, willing to train themselves and understand that it's not wrong to understand how to use a gun. It's not wrong to know how to defend oneself against a potential threat. Because again, this is the spirit of the time that we are in. We need to be completely aware that we shouldn't live in a state of delusion, pretending that we can just live in this sort of nonviolent bubble and everything will be fine. But I think this is the real question, is people have different levels of comfort, and that includes myself, about what I or what anybody would be willing to do to actively resist and to not be merely defensive, but to be proactive and to take certain steps necessary in order to ensure that not only are we going to survive the next few decades, but to ensure that life itself and the things that we actually love, you know, that we're in love with the life of this planet, and we're in love with humanity itself. And we see that we're undercutting ourselves by living in this way, because like you pointed to that beautiful place that you would visit as a young man, a young person. And you knew that people had lived in this land for however many hundreds or thousands of years. And sure, there may have been some, you know, problems, but ultimately they knew how to live in some kind of balance with the life around them, and they understood their place within it. So I think that oftentimes, I'm kind of all over the place with this little rant here, but generally I think people think that when they read your writings, or, you know, people that are from your perspective, they think, well, they hate human beings because they want to destroy civilization. They want to destroy the things that make our lives possible, our lifestyles possible. But I think that is a really shallow love. That's a really shallow appreciation, because to truly love humanity and to truly love life itself requires that we take a more radical approach to how we can, you know, get through the next few decades, let alone the next century. Yeah. Sorry, that's just my two cents on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on board with that too. And you know, I talk about a lot of dark shit, you know, and yeah. I like to have those real conversations. My sister's partner, he'll come into the house, you know, I haven't seen him for weeks or months, and you know, he'll sit down and first thing he'll be like, okay, what's it gonna take to dismantle white supremacy? He doesn't even say like how you doing, how's your day going? And I love that just because like I'm right with him. I'm not really a small talk type of guy, but you know, at the same time, you know, I went down to the river and jumped in earlier today and I'm spending the evening with some good friends of mine. And you know, I love life. I love people. I love the world. You know, it's a blessing to be here every day, you know, every day that we get to experience, even if we are living in this time. And I kind of feel like in a way, although it's sort of a double-edged sword because we're cursed to live in this time, right? I mean, I daydream about being born into an era when, you know, everyone has their problems, right? In any era in history, people are going to have serious life and death issues going on and major stresses, you know, throughout their life at various times. But we're maybe one of the first generations, you know, maybe going back to the atomic age, that people have had to have these existential worries about not only ourselves and our families, but the entire world, you know? And that's hard. And it, you know, it's no wonder to me that most people sort of retreat to their homes and spend all their time on their phones and binging on Netflix and, you know, whatever it is. It's not surprising because that's extremely traumatic, you know? Just that reality that we live with on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, one of my friends often says that love is a verb. And I love that because we have to love the world so hard that we're going to do what it takes, you know? And we live in this sort of like postmodern, post-truth era where we've been so inundated with mass media and you know, all that sort of stuff, computer rendered movies and special effects and so on from childhood that I think sometimes we have a hard time distinguishing what's real from what's fake, you know? Like our brains have been so heavily indoctrinated by this culture that people don't realize down in their bones, in their body, like what that means, that this culture is killing the planet. Like this culture is murdering the planet. And, you know, I'm not trying to say like it's your fault or it's my fault or anybody who's listening, because we were born into this world, right? I mean, I'm somewhat of a Tupac fan. That's one of my favorite lyrics of his. Don't blame me. I was given this world. I didn't make it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously Tupac is a whole other political issue, but,
yeah.
But you know, we were born into this world, this traumatic world, this world in which just to exist, we have to destroy because of the way this life is set up. And, you know, we're not real in charge as individuals, but what we can do is fight and is organize and is work to change it. And that's one of the interesting things to me about this essay collection is that, you know, I put together the list of essays, and as I was doing it, I sort of realized that they're more or less in chronological order, not completely, but they sort of trace this story arc for myself in terms of my own political evolution. You know, there's things that I wrote in these essays that I don't agree with now. You know, my own perspective has changed or become more nuanced in different ways. But I, you know, I didn't want to edit them because it's really interesting to me to look at the whole sweep of my own political evolution over time. And, you know, one of the sayings that I really like, it's a military maxim, and it is, amateurs talk strategy, dilettantes talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. And the basic idea of that quote, that saying, is that it's easy to talk about, you know, what needs to happen, strategy or what our goal is big picture. It's harder to start talking about, okay, what are our methods? What are our tactics for getting there? How are we going to achieve that? And then it's hardest to actually get down to the nitty gritty of logistics. So, who's going to do it? Where are they going to sleep? How are they going to get to where they need to go? What are they going to eat? How are they going to get the supplies they need? All that type of stuff. So, we were talking earlier about the big picture, and, I think that we all sort of need to stick our head out of the water and see that big picture. But in some senses, then we need to, choose our target and dive back in. And another quote that I love, and I'm forgetting who said it first, but it was a feminist activist or writer, and I'm forgetting who, but somebody asked her, what can I do as just one person? And her response was, don't be one person. And I love that because, we're social creatures, and I think that's one of the big downsides if you look at, like, Ted Kaczynski, like you mentioned, or the Earth Liberation Front. They were mostly kind of operating in this vacuum. And, I think we need to create a culture, a resistance culture that's strong, in which even if you're not going to participate, even if you don't have the personal character or the physical health or what have you to go out there and make a revolution, then you're going to be an active supporter, and you're going to work to build the culture and normalize that to such an extent that, when somebody does something like blow up a dam or what have you, that you and everyone you know, everyone who you've had conversations with for years about these topics isn't going to say, that's crazy, why did they do that? They're going to say, hell yeah, now let's get the rest of them, Let's other people do it. And they're, and I think we need that culture. It's so important. And, recently I met someone who has a sort of off-grid community, intentional community with permaculture gardens and a bunch of people living there. And what I loved about meeting this person was that, they were doing all that. And then they were also saying, we need to bring down the power grid. And, because they to me represent the potential of that vision, because, I think we need people building those alternative systems, but I get frustrated when I see people doing that type of permaculture work and alternatives work without the explicit political message that what's happening now needs to go because it's murderous and it needs to go as soon as possible. And, and actively sort of supporting that more confrontational side of the movement.
Right.
So,
well, it reminds me, when you said that, it makes me think about how oftentimes people treat their political beliefs, I guess, their political convictions, as if it's like a lifestyle choice. I'm a permaculture farmer and I choose to do this, but you can do your thing in the cities and you can do your thing. I just don't bother me and I'll stay over here and do my thing. And if people want to join me, cool. But if not, it's more like, yes, we're building this community, but we're doing it not only to build something here, but we want to actively create a culture that is going to resist the dominant culture, something that we can use this as a base, as a place to live and to rest and to, have a place to build something. But ultimately we need to recognize that it has to stand in opposition to the dominant culture. I think that oftentimes we forget that. And I think that that's sort of the trick, is that oftentimes I think our activism or our political beliefs and political commitments, we treat them sort of like something you can go shopping for. Right. I think that that's kind of the insidious, nature of our culture and of maybe consumerism or capitalism or materialism or whatever ism you want to throw at it, is that it sort of bleeds into everything. And so one thing, you know, talking about the individual versus everything, that's sort of a part of this culture that we have as well, where it's like, especially in America, this idea of the rugged individual, you know, we're going to go out and you can just prepare for the apocalypse all by yourself and just protect your own. Well, you know, that's not what it's about. It's really actually about building community and actually reclaiming something that had been lost in the march towards progress, right? Quotations around that. I think that that's something that really clicked when I was a kid and I was starting to study anarchism and study, alternative ways of looking and thinking about human beings and human nature. And just actually in the past year or so, I was researching a really excellent book, about the witch hunts in Europe and how this transition from feudal society into capitalism was this really, really violent transition that happened over hundreds of years. And of course women were on the blunt end of that, of course, with thousands, hundreds of thousands possibly of women that were executed and just slaughtered and tortured, because they were a threat to the new rising dominant order that was emerging. But anyway, my main point was that by saying that is that we need to remind ourselves that by resisting capitalism, by resisting the culture of empire, as you put it, we have to reflect on how it's affected us and how our own conception of ourselves has been formed by the culture that we're actively trying to undermine. And I think that's actually a really tricky game almost to play, where you're sort of like, I was thinking about how the individualization of struggle, is really the thing that's actually, I think, partly undermines a lot of the struggles that people are trying to engage in, because again, I think there's a lot of things within a capitalist culture that tries to diffuse tension, right? And I think you mentioned these resistance movements like the Stratfor strategy. They understand that, okay, a little bit of resistance is fine. We can handle that. But as soon as it reaches a certain point, we need to actively resist that and stop it from happening. And I think that they fit that within the equation. I guess you could say the algorithm of capitalism. If you got a bunch of black bloc anarchists in Portland throwing, you know, Molotov cocktails at cops and overthrowing, you know, cop cars and putting them on fire and throwing bricks through the windows of Starbucks, that's totally within the algorithm that's understood and can be accounted for. But when you start blowing up dams, when you start actively undermining the infrastructure of industrial civilization and its ability to trade and to move oil and, you know, do all the things that it needs to do in order to continue functioning, that is much bigger and much further than what they're able to cope with and to fit within their algorithm and within their equation. And I think people need to realize, like, again, it's that getting into the nitty-gritty details, but also keeping your head above the water and seeing the bigger picture. And yeah. And that's the balance. I think that's important.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the essays, probably the most risque essay in the collection, is called Ecological Special Forces. And it's basically about how I think ecological resistance groups need to operate in a professional sort of military-like fashion, similar to how special forces or commando units operate. That essay sort of goes a little more deeply into that. But, you know, yeah, just like you're saying, you know, people smashing windows is ultimately symbolic. Those buildings usually all have insurance and, you know, so they might not lose any money at all from that taking place. So, you know, I'm sure it's a pain for them and they don't like it. And, you know, if there's a choice between doing nothing and breaking the window of a horrible corporate place, then I would support breaking the window for sure. But, you know, I think if we're going to turn this thing around, I think we need to start thinking in a different way, you know, because we've been doing this sort of symbolic and defensive struggles for so long. It's been happening for so, so long, and it's not working. You know, I just read a biography of Tecumseh, who was a Shawnee warrior who unified a bunch of different tribes during the very early days of the United States existing as a country, and essentially tried to stop the westward expansion. He was killed, I think, in the War of 1812 between the British Empire and the nascent United States. And, you know, he was a true threat because he recognized that they couldn't fight alone. They couldn't exist as these isolated nations, some of them making deals with the colonizers, some of them fighting the colonizers, some of them trading with the colonizers, sort of each nation for themselves. And so he formed a military alliance and fought back. And, you know, they ended up losing, of course, because, like I said, in that Hollywood world. But, you know, we've sort of lost that tradition. I think it's a very American thing, I think, that sort of lifestyle resistance. And I think it goes back a lot longer than this country and in other countries, too. I mean, people were talking about, like, lifestyle anarchists, you know, during the days of the Russian Revolution and how problematic they were over there while that was going on. And you know, so it's not a new issue per se, but, you know, I used to be really into solar panels. I used to think that riding your bike was the greatest possible thing you could do to save the planet. You know, I understand that world, and I still, as, you know, as an individual, I try to make ethical choices about my consumption and the way that I move through the world. But I don't really pretend that those are going to change the world. I just do it because it's the right thing to do. You know, it's just sort of like, okay, I get in the habit, and then it's just what I do after that. But, you know, I think that we need to start thinking much bigger, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, man, you know, time really is short. We can't pretend that it's not. It's really hard to get my head out of the, like you mentioned, the habits of the day to day life, but you have to remind yourself, like, you know, there's really not much time to waste. Actually, there's no time to waste. There's never been time to waste, to be honest. Doesn't matter what point in human history you live in, there's never been time to waste. But regarding this particular subject and this moment that we are all in, we don't choose to be born in this time that we're in. And I think that that's the real hard thing, is like, people think, well, my ancestors never had to deal with these problems. Like, they never had to deal with these huge ecological catastrophes, these crises, these converging crises. They had their own crises they had to confront. But this is wholly new for, I think, for humanity to face. And I think that's really the biggest thing to overcome, is the recognition that, I mean, you look at evolutionary history, human beings have never had to really adapt or confront cognitively the implications of this form of crisis, I guess you could say, that's unfolding right now. I don't know if that makes any sense, but, you know, I had this interview with William Rees, who was the co-originator of the ecological footprint analysis, and the majority of that interview was him, of course, explaining ecological footprint analysis, but then us getting into the cognitive limitations that exist we're just not very well equipped to contemplate these big issues, these big problems. And, you know, for the first time ever in human history, as far as I know, we're a global system. We're a global civilization, and we're a part of a global civilization. And sure, there's a lot of factions within this civilization. You have the United States and its interests, and Russia and its interests, and all these different nation states and corporations. But ultimately, the same interests are to keep this thing going as long as possible. And if you're actively resisting that, I mean, you are... I was just thinking about how often I feel really alienated from this culture, and how this podcast and me reaching out to people like you and speaking to people like you, it does two things. One, it makes me really grateful that I can have these conversations with people like you and talk about the things that we're discussing with seriousness, because I can't talk to anybody about what we're talking about in my community. I can't say to anybody around me, like, oh, we need to actually blow up this dam. Like, oh, that's funny, but no, we know that's ridiculous. We need that, you know, and I'm like, no, we need to, there's serious things that need to be done. And there's nothing like that going on where I live. And I think that's the case for many people probably picking up on this podcast or other forms of writing or materials that are out there that are coming into this consciousness and awareness of where we are at. And it's sort of the blessing and curse of having something like the internet, recognizing that we need to use this as a tool, but let's not pretend that it's just this, neutral technology. Right. And the same thing goes for any of the technologies, that we have in industrial civilization today. You know, there's this funny part of me, and I'm sorry, I'll say this part here. I was reading an essay of yours and you were discussing driving to, I can now remember the name of it and I apologize, but it was a resistance camp. I believe it was an indigenous, I think it was up in British Columbia, if I remember correctly. And you were driving a car. Okay. And this is my brain, right? What the fuck are you doing resisting oil companies and gas companies and all that? And you're driving a car, you know? And then this part of me gets triggered back to this time I spoke to Derek Jensen, where I mentioned something like, you are not a hypocrite. You know, don't think of it that way. You don't choose to be born in the time and place that you're in the culture that you are in. Use the tools that you have available to you to actively resist car culture. You might have to drive a car to do that. May seem like a contradiction, but use the tools that are available to you to actively resist this homicidal, psychopathic culture that we are born into. Anyway, that's something I think about. It's like this initial judgment that I have about reading something like that. And then my rethinking that judgment being like, no, it's okay. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of like, in a way, I think we are hypocrites. I mean, I think we all wish we could live in a way that was more in accord with our values, but we just can't in this culture. And, you know, there's something like, I don't know how many, 10 million, 20 million, 30 million new cars built and added to the total number of cars being used on the planet every year. You know, so, I mean, any influence that we can have as individuals with our consumption patterns is really just meaningless, you know? And I think this is one of the big, I am just finishing up a book right now, a collaborative book with Derek Jensen and Lear Keith that's called Bright Green Lies. And one of the key things that we dive into in that book is the whole mythology around efficiency and the idea that, you know, we use more energy efficient light bulbs and we use more energy efficient cars and we insulate our buildings better and so on. And this will protect the planet. And we talk about this guy, Stanley Jevons, who was a British economist, and he was active in the early days of the Industrial Revolution in England. And so everything was powered by steam engines, and they were using steam engines to pump water out of coal mines and to haul the coal and to run the factories and for everything. And so they invented a new type of steam engine that was much more efficient than the previous type. And people expected that because of this, the amount of coal that was being used was going to go down. But what actually happened was that because the new machines were more efficient, they enabled cost savings, and the companies used those cost savings to expand production and buy more steam engines, which burned even more coal. So in the end, the increased efficiency actually drove more growth and more total use of coal. And, you know, I think that's really the case. You know, I saw a bumper sticker the other day on this big truck, and, you know, I drive a truck, so maybe I can't talk about it, but the bumper sticker said, this truck runs on gas saved by your Prius. And I thought it was, you know, obviously the meaning, the coded message there, not so subtly coded, is fuck you, basically, and fuck the planet. But it's actually true, you know? It's actually true. I mean, in so many cases,
I mean, you look at green, so-called green energy with solar and wind and so on. And the thing is, energy consumption is growing overall. It's getting bigger and bigger every year as, you know, new data centers come online to power Facebook and Instagram and everything else. And, you know, new Bitcoin mining comes online and new industries open up, like the, you know, legal cannabis industry in Oregon and Colorado. And, you know, these other states that are legalizing it now, they're a massive and rapidly growing source of electricity consumption. And they're even causing blackouts in some areas because there's such an additional load on the grid that's come onto it so quickly. And so the idea that, you know, efficiency or sort of using these new technologies in new ways that are less destructive will enable the culture to stop killing the planet, it's a total myth. It's a total fantasy. Because these things just make empire stronger, and that's why the US military is a major supporter of so-called green energy. Because it is great for remote military installations and allows them to be more self-sufficient, so it strengthens empire in that way. But you know, I think they're also looking at, you know, the oil wars that we've seen in the past, and they're saying this is really expensive and difficult and, you know, dangerous. So maybe if we can just, you know, have our homegrown energy supplies, you know, we won't need to waste as much military force going to get control of resources, and we can instead focus on projecting our power where we want to. And, you know, so, you know, I think that's definitely the case. And I get two quick points too in response to what you were saying just a minute ago. You know, you were talking about how people in your community have a hard time hearing about the need to, you know, blow up dams or whatever. And I guess I want to say that I don't think violence is the end all. You know, I don't really believe in revolution for the sake of revolution, or that it's like this deity that we need to worship and think is the best thing ever. I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's a desperate response to desperate situations. And, you know, I think that, you know, I have a friend who's a professor, conservation biology, and he was involved in getting the Elwha Dam taken down on the Elwha River in Washington State. And it took a lot of years to get that dam taken down, but it's down now. And the response from the non-humans has been just stunning. I mean, there were salmon spawning upstream of the dam within like 2 days after the dam went down. And, you know, their populations are growing and all these species are returning, and it's just amazing what's happening there. And I don't really care how that dam came down. They used, you know, the state apparatus to take it down, but it's down, and that's what's important to me. So, you know, if and when people have the opportunity to do good work in, you know, using whatever tactics are available, I say go for it for sure. But I think, you know, like I said earlier, I think we need to keep that big picture perspective. And I guess the final thing I wanted to say is, you were talking again about how hard it is to live knowing that this is all going down, you know, the psychological burden of that. And I guess I also want to say that one of the ways I try and flip that around with myself is, I like to think sometimes that it's really an honor to be born into this time, because whatever ancestors or spirits or gods, goddesses you believe in or not, they thought that you could do something in this time. You know, you were brought to this time not to be a spectator, not to sit on the sidelines, not to just watch as the world went to shit, you know. And so in that sense, I think it's sort of a duty that we've been born in this generation. We're being called to action. And I think that's a blessing. I think one of the worst things about the culture that we live in today is sort of a lack of meaning, you know. So many, you mentioned before the interview, Fight Club, you know, which is a very popular movie, which has a lot of things you can discuss about it. But obviously sort of a nihilism is one of the themes of that book and film. And, you know, people just sort of going about their day-to-day life, working the 9-to-5 so that they can retire at, you know, 66 and then, you know, die at 75 after, you know, sitting in a chair for the last 10 years of their life. And I think that being born into this time of crisis is something that we can build meaning around. And that's something that I've worked to do in my life is to get, you know, some sense of who I am and what I believe in, what I care about from this work, and allow that to sort of be a bedrock for who I am. And, you know, from my conversations with Indigenous friends and people I've worked with and people who come from more intact communities, you know, it's always sort of a key element of intact communities is coming of age ceremonies and sort of this idea of roles that, you know, healthy societies all have different, people all have a role to play. And it's sort of, you know what's expected of you and you know what you need to do. And that doesn't mean that it's not hard or you don't face whatever, you know, of course, but there's sort of a sense of security that you know where you come from, you know what you believe in, you know what you and your community has to do in order to pass on a living world to the next generation. And, you know, I think that's sort of the calling that we all have to find in ourselves in this trying time. And it's hard and it's scary and it's difficult, but I think it's also a blessing and a real blessing to be born in this time. Mm.
I think that's a beautiful way of reflecting on that. Yeah, and I do sense that there's something true. And I think also, you could be a complete atheist. You may not believe in any of the things you mentioned, any God, or may not believe in the fact that maybe ancestors are watching over you, or, you know, any of that. You may not believe in any of that, but I think that whether you believe it's real or not, whether you believe that is the case or not, have that perspective anyway, because it's going to maybe shape your intentions and shape your work, you know?
Yeah.
At the very least, do it for those around you and those that you love.
Right.
And in the life of this planet, the places that you love, I think that something that I think really fuels this movement and really fuels this resistance to the dominant culture is a real love of place. I was trying to explain to a friend the other day, I was explaining that the United States or America or whatever is an idea. It's not an actual place. This is something that's been projected onto the land that we are in, that we are on. And all the things that have been built on top of it have been as a result of this idea of America and what America is. But we should not associate America and what America is as an idea, as an ideological structure. We should not confuse that with the place that we are in. So I'm here in Idaho. I think you're somewhere in the Northwest in Oregon. And we love the places that we are in. Although I may hate the culture that I am a part of, you know, I recognize that there's still so much beauty worth fighting for and appreciating. And, that's what it's all about. You know, keep the perspective, keep the right perspective. And I think everything could fall into place, you know? So I think what you said though was really beautiful. And I think it's a really beautiful way of, I guess, wrapping up in some way this conversation that we've had so far. Max, it's been a really good conversation and I really want to direct people to your work. I know that you have your website, maxwilbert.org, I believe. Yep, maxwilbert.org. You're also on Facebook. I know that you're on Facebook and of course your excellent collection, We Choose to Speak, a collection of essays has been released. So I just want to ask how people can find your work. Obviously there's the website that I just mentioned, but how can people find out more about your book and anything else that you've got going on? Also, you have your upcoming collaboration with Derek Jensen. I can't remember the other author. I apologize for Bright Green Lies. But if you can give us some information about these projects, that would be fantastic.
Sure, yeah. So my website is maxwilbert.org, and people can contact me there. You can order copies of the book directly from me. I think you can get them on Amazon, too, and probably cheaper than from me, but, you know, hopefully people will support me. I grew up in the Amazon city, and, you know, it's been ruined by that company.
Yeah,
so,
no, I don't want to. I've been actively trying to steer people away from buying books on Amazon, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you got to do the cheapest available thing, and I definitely appreciate that. So do whatever you got to do. I don't really care where you got to buy it from.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I'm on Facebook. Unfortunately, it's a good communication tool. I have the news feed completely blocked, which helps break some of their addictive technology methodology. But I put out some videos and some stuff on there occasionally. I release some videos on YouTube, and yeah, and I'm organizing in Oregon and doing some organizing projects in the Great Basin too, around forest destruction and water issues and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm active in the world, and I love to connect with people via email and stuff, but you know, in person is always better. So get in touch if you're interested in talking more or anything else.
Yeah, and those videos, I mean, I think when I first actually became aware of you and your perspective, your work, was through these really interesting monologues that you would post, these videos that you would post, and discussing a lot of the things that we discussed in this episode. So I do recommend people check out your YouTube page, and those are on Facebook as well. But yeah, Max, you're doing wonderful work. So thank you so much for speaking with me and having this conversation with me.
Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week. And as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna, said, take it easy, dude, but take it. No.